Diane. Great to be with you. On my mind this week, how the Trump presidency is changing economic ties with countries around the world, and how our government functions here at home. President Trump is in Davos, Switzerland this week with a message of America first. But as my guest, trade expert Douglas Irwin explains,
you have to sort of go beyond that rhetoric and see what is the substance of the policies behind it. And I think the way, unfortunately, a lot of other countries are interpreting it, and perhaps correctly, is America alone.
Then a conversation with David K. Johnston, a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative journalist. He says the media is doing a fairly good job of covering the palace intrigue of this White House, but that most of us are failing to grasp just how profoundly this administration is reshaping government agencies.
This is not the fox in the hen house. This is bringing in foxes to destroy the existing hen house and design a new one for the benefit of the foxes.
First, here's Doug Irwin, professor of economics at Dartmouth College. Douglas Irwin, thanks for joining us.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you. President Trump is in Davos with a message of America first. Is that message at odds with the rest of the countries there? How much of a disconnect is that?
Well, first of all, you have to sort of go beyond that rhetoric and see what is the substance of the policy positions behind it. And I think the way, unfortunately, a lot of other countries are interpreting it, and perhaps correctly, is America alone. So some of his advisors have been speaking out saying just because we think America should come first doesn't mean that we won't be participating in some of these global initiatives. And yet we've pulled out of the Paris Climate Accord. We've pulled out of TPP. We seem to be withdrawing back on any number of initiatives. And so I think the rest of the world takes that as a signal as U.S. retreat and not participating in a lot of these ventures.
So on Tuesday, you had 11 countries agree to join the Trans-Pacific Partnership. They announced they'd agreed on a deal and would be signing it in March. This is the agreement the U.S. initiated, so now they're going ahead without the U.S. Tell us what the impact of that will be.
Well, the impact is that we're going to be excluded from a pact of 11 countries or so with fairly large markets, and they're going to be reducing tariffs and promoting trade within that bloc, and we're going to be outside of it. So American beef producers will face hurdles in selling in Japan that Australian beef producers do not face. American car producers and manufacturers will face hurdles in Vietnam that other manufacturers from Japan will not face. So I think it's a missed opportunity in terms of participating in this larger market, particularly since under TPP, the U.S. really didn't have to change its policy all that much. So we're not getting the benefit of market access in other countries. And I think we'll have to come back to that at some point in the future with a different administration.
So we're putting ourselves on the sidelines.
Exactly. Now, when it comes back to trade and TPP, the administration originally would have said, well, we don't like this big agreement, but we can get a better deal, and we want a better deal by pursuing bilateral agreements with all the TPP countries.
You know, that sounds good, but how realistic is it?
I don't think it's very realistic. First of all, that means 11 bilateral trade agreements have to be negotiated. At the same time, we're renegotiating NAFTA and trying to confront China. We just don't have the trade policy officials to negotiate all those things. And it's also untrue, in my opinion, that we'll get better deals working with countries bilaterally than we would have gotten through the TPP, where there are many different trade-offs across different sectors. And I think you get a better deal when you get more countries around the table than when you deal with countries one by one.
You know, it sure is confusing to hear the president say one thing and his director of the National Economic Council, whom you mentioned, Gary Cohn, say quite another. What do you make of that?
What I make of it, at least in terms of the trade realm, which I study most closely, is we have never really heard a well-articulated statement about what constitutes a better deal. So they say, we don't like these past trade agreements. We want new ones that will be better deals for the United States. But they never really specify, well, on what grounds and what basis, what specific provisions do you think would constitute a better deal? And so you don't get, there's not a coherent theme in terms of what they want, what their goal is, what are they driving for? And when you don't have that end goal in place, you can get a lot of different statements from different officials about what exactly it is they're doing because there's no clarity on what they're doing.
But do you think they're coordinating? Is there a good cop, bad cop going on here?
It could be, but once again, when you look at what the U.S. Trade Representative is doing, appointed by President Trump, Robert Lighthizer, he's pushing the Mexicans and the Canadians in the NAFTA renegotiation, and he's putting them in a very difficult spot in terms of what the U.S. demands are. They're in terms of we're going to have an automatic provision to sunset or get rid of NAFTA after 5 years unless it's renewed. The whole point of trade agreements is you want to lock in certain policies so that businesses and trade can function smoothly without uncertainty. So there are a lot of different provisions that they've been pushing for in the NAFTA renegotiation that I think are unacceptable. And then that brings into question whether they really want renegotiated NAFTA or whether they're just looking for an excuse for someone to pull out and have the whole thing collapse.
So what about the announcement on Monday about new tariffs on solar panels and washing machines? What is that going to do, not only to our trade negotiations, but also to American consumers?
Well, I think the solar panel decision in particular is going to raise the price of imported solar panels, and we're largely dependent on those imports. The two firms that filed the petition, it's sort of odd that we have this America First trade policy, and yet the two firms that wanted the higher tariffs are a Chinese-owned firm and a German-owned firm. They're not really American, and they don't employ a huge number of workers. We have a huge number of workers employed in the solar panel installation business, putting up these panels and maintaining them. And those jobs are in jeopardy because if you raise the price of solar panels to consumers, they're more apt to not adopt them and continue on with non-renewable energy sources. So I think it's bad environmental policy, bad jobs policy. At the same time, I would say that both that decision and the washing machine decision, that's part of this these trade laws that we have that private firms can invoke that Congress set up. And it's quite normal for most presidential administrations to grant import relief to some of these petitioners. So it's not something that Trump administration initiated itself. It's in response to petitions that they've received. Hmm. And most presidents going back to Clinton, Bush, Reagan, Obama even have imposed such tariffs in the past on different industries.
Is the raising of tariffs on solar panels another strike against the idea of environmental protection?
Technically, the environmental policy is sort of separate than the trade policy, but one can't help but notice that it is consistent with the Trump administration's push for more oil exploration and coal mining and things of that sort. So it's certainly going to put a handicap and a dent into the demand for solar panels. Whether that was deliberate policy or just a byproduct, I don't know.
His advisors say he'll take action against imported steel, aluminum, and other products. What do you make of that?
Yeah, so that's under another statute of U.S. trade law that Congress set up long ago, where for national security reasons, the president is authorized after an investigation to impose tariffs on imports to protect domestic producers. The steel industry has always wanted protection from imports for many, many decades, and they've invoked various trade laws and to sort of get that. And this is just sort of a new iteration in a long playing out story of the steel industry trying to block imports. I think they've actually had a tougher time with this case because it's being granted not because imports are coming in some unfair way, but they say it's on national security grounds. And even those in the Department of Defense and elsewhere think that we're not unduly reliant on foreign sources of supply. Much of our supply comes from Canada. And in terms of imports have not been surging into the market and harming domestic producers. So we'll have to see what plays out. But certainly, given the president's rhetoric on the campaign trail and all the signals he's given in office, is that he would try to do something to restrict imports of steel.
Here's what I don't get. The president has said that all these tariffs are going to create new jobs for America and for Americans. Is he right here?
I don't think he's right, because what you're really doing is trading off jobs. So if we start blocking imports of raw steel, yes, that raises the domestic price, and you will get domestic producers here in the United States producing more and possibly hiring more people. Although I should add that we've been losing jobs in the steel industry, not because of imports, but because of technological change. It's just become much more efficient and much more technologically advanced, and so we need fewer steel workers to produce the same amount of steel that we've always produced. But the problem, of course, is that by raising the price of steel, we raise the cost of inputs to downstream industries that use steel as part of their production process. So the auto industry buys a lot of steel. John Deere and Caterpillar buy a lot of steel. And when we raise their costs, we make them less internationally competitive, because when Caterpillar tries to export heavy earth-moving equipment, they're competing against Komatsu and other foreign suppliers that don't have to pay those high steel input costs. And we handicap their ability to compete. So we may be losing as many jobs, if not more jobs, and certainly jeopardizing the jobs in the downstream industries as opposed to those that might be created upstream in the original industry.
And cost to consumers, I would
Absolutely.
Think, would go up. On Wednesday, you had a South Korean multinational that sells washers and dryers here said it's going to be raising its retail price by about $50. So, I mean, any way you look at it, it seems the end product is going to hurt Americans in one way or another.
And this is particularly pronounced in the solar panel case, because one reason why Americans have been moving towards solar energy so much in recent years is the price has really come down a lot. And if consumers are aware that the price is going to go up, not only will they have to pay more, but they just won't install new solar panels or shift to that source of energy. So it could put a dent in that quite a bit.
You've certainly had other presidents imposing tariffs. For example, President Obama on tires, President Bush on steel. What's the difference here?
The difference is that the past administrations have sort of imposed such tariffs with some reluctance. They did it for political purposes or for some legal reason, but they were generally reluctant. And many presidents have sort of turned away industries that were knocking at the door asking for higher tariffs. The difference is this administration seems to welcome these petitions. And so we've just had solar panels and washing machines, but the fear among many trade economists is that we're going to get many, many more of these cases, because now industry realizes that this is a sympathetic administration. They want to impose trade restrictions, and so their petitions will be welcome. So these pressures in the past have been sort of muted because administrations gave sort of a negative signal, but this administration is giving a positive signal to any particular producer group that wants to get higher prices through trade restrictions.
Doug, you talked earlier about NAFTA and this question of negotiating bilaterally. That seems to be what Trump is all about. Does that approach miss something in terms of what our trade goals are or should be?
So this gets to, you know, what is it the Trump administration is really concerned about? What goals do they want to achieve? And one thing they've always come back to is they really think the trade deficit is a bad thing. And not just the aggregate trade deficit, but they want to balance trade bilaterally between partners. And most economists think that's really the wrong way to think about international trade. So, for example, you and I, presumably, we run big trade deficits with our grocery store. We buy a lot from them. They don't buy anything from us. But we earn trade surpluses with our employers. We're selling something to them. They pay our paycheck, but we don't buy anything from them. So this idea that we need to have balanced trade with Mexico, balanced trade with Canada, balanced trade with any host of other countries isn't really an issue as far as economists are concerned. The overall balance you could have a debate about. When we look at Canada, he has tweeted and pointed out in the past we have a merchandise trade deficit with Canada. But what he doesn't point out is we have a trade surplus in services with Canada. Hmm. In fact, our overall balance is positive with them. We also have a very large trade surplus with Australia. He's always said trade balances are an indicator of unfair trade. Well, are we being unfair to Australia and running a surplus? in terms of merchandise? Are we unfair with Canada in terms of running our services surplus? So once you start playing that game of thinking that some sort of imbalance is unfair inherently, other countries can play that against us, and it's just a recipe for more managed trade and more trade restrictions.
Where do you think he's getting the best information on trade?
He's getting the best information from members of Congress. So I don't think he's reading the media or outside advisors or things of that sort. But this is very interesting. When his presumption is NAFTA was just very, very bad, very, very unfair. He says this constantly. And there was a press report recently where he was meeting with a bunch of congressmen and asked them, should we pull out of NAFTA? And none of them raised their hand. A lot of the senators were and congressmen were from the Midwest. They were from farm states who are really dependent on exporting soybeans, corn, wheat to Mexico. And we opened up the Mexican market with NAFTA, and they see their farmers and their constituents as benefiting from NAFTA. So I think it supposedly came as a big surprise to him to find out that there are actually some people who think NAFTA is a good idea, and we've benefited from it. And so the more he hears those voices, the more he'll have, hopefully, a more balanced view about what that agreement has done to the United States.
You've got a new book coming out on the history of U.S. trade, titled Clashing Over Commerce, Taking the Long View. Have we been in this kind of spot before?
Well, we've since World War II, not really. Most presidents since World War II have been relatively in favor of trade agreements and trying to open up markets and cooperate with other countries on matters of trade. This administration seems to want to pivot in a different way. But when you go further back in history, and in fact, some of the president's advisors have mentioned this as well, we've had very high tariffs in the past, from the Civil War right up to the Smoot-Hawley tariff in 1930. We had pretty high duties on imports. Prior to the Civil War, there was a big North-South divide and political dissension over what our tariff policy should be. So one of the themes of the book is that there's really been no period in U.S. history when trade policy has not been controversial. It's always been controversial, politically divisive. It's just we're entering into a new phase where the president seems to want to lead that charge.
And where do you think we're headed?
The future is always uncertain and difficult to predict, but I like to think, having looked back at more than 200 years of trade policy history, that there are a lot of economic interests that have a stake in trade. There's a lot of legal provisions that constrain what the president can do. Actually, under the Constitution, Congress is given the authority over trade policy, not the president. So there's even a question of whether the president could legally pull the United States out of NAFTA and what that might mean. I think there would be a big debate and dispute about that. But I think despite the rhetoric, I think there are some of these political and economic factors that really constrain how much the presidents can move the ship of state on trade in a different way.
Doug Irwin, thank you so much for joining us today.
It's been a real pleasure talking with you.
Now a quick break.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily.
Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
And we're back. Here's the investigative journalist, David K. Johnston. His new book is titled, It's Even Worse Than You Think, What the Trump Administration is Doing to America. David, it's good to have you here with us.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here, Diane.
I must say, all of us are somewhat confused by the Trump presidency. What do you think it's about?
It's about Donald. The prior 44 presidents were all over the map. You know, there were smart ones and dumb ones. There were honest ones, corrupt ones, great ones, middling ones, terrible ones. But every one of those presidents tried to make America better. I mean, even Chester Arthur was a crooked New York politician who became president only because his president died and he was elevated from vice president. called in all his corrupt cronies to the White House and said to them, "Gentlemen, no more. I'm now the President of the United States, and you will not darken the door of the White House." Donald Trump is not about America, about making the country better. He is about Donald Trump, period, full stop. He is about the glorification of the self-proclaimed, genetically superior, smartest man with the greatest memory, who's the world's leading expert on 20 subjects, Donald Trump.
You have known this man for many, many years.
Almost 30 years now.
To what extent have you talked with him face to face?
Well, I've talked to him many times face to face, but not in recent years. The last time we spoke, he called me at home to yell at me, which he's done many times over the years, and threatened to sue me. This was in April of 2016, and Donald said he didn't want to answer my questions. And then he said, "If I don't like the way you write it, I'll sue you." And I said, "Donald, you're a public figure." That means he would have to prove I actually lied and knew I was lying. And he said, "I know I'm a public figure. I don't care anyway. I'll sue you." Click. And that's how Donald operates. He's a bully. And it was a little surprising to me, actually, because Donald knows from our past conversations that I've personally hunted down a killer. I've run into a burning building once and twice toward them and done a lot of other things like that. And he knows I don't intimidate because he's tried repeatedly to do that. And I thought, boy, he's just a little out of control here. Normally he'd be a little more subtle than this.
But he's no longer subtle.
Not in the least.
You know, it's interesting. You talk about the language he now uses.
Well, when I met Donald, and by the way, last night when I was in Baltimore, I spoke with someone who's known him about the same amount of time who had the same observation. Donald could speak in coherent paragraphs, and he could carry on a conversation. It might be full of vagaries and a lot of bluster because he's fundamentally a con artist and a grifter, but he could hold a thought in his head. Now he speaks in what I call word salad. It's adjectives, you know, the tax bill. It's great. It's terrific. It's fantastic. He speaks in these vague, unclear things when he's not reading. And, you know, as we all get older, we decline cognitively. When I was a boy, I could multiply four digits by four digits in my head. It was a little parlor game. You give me your phone number. It's 10 digits these days, Diane. I have to write it down.
Yeah, gotcha.
But Donald clearly is not as sharp as he was. And you add to that his appalling ignorance, and this is not good for the country.
And that's what you talk about in this new book. You talk not just about how he operates, but what it is he's doing to our country.
Yeah, you know, in journalism, we've never done a particularly good job of covering government. We do a good job of covering politics and political controversies. And while I think the coverage of the campaign was atrocious, the coverage in the White House has been really quite remarkable in many ways. But we're not covering what's going on that's being done to you. So Michael Wolff's book came out, Fire and Fury. And it, by the way, confirmed everything that was in my earlier book, The Making of Donald Trump, about Donald. And it's a good read, but he's a gossip writer. And that's what you got, is this nice palace intrigue, gossipy story with lots of indiscreet comments by people. My book is about what is the Trump administration doing to you? And while Trump didn't personally do this, the people he brought in right around him have turned loose what I call political termites into the structure of our government. And they're eating away at it unseen, the same way that termites eat away at the structure of your house if you don't know they're there.
So you're talking about people like the head of the EPA.
Well, more than the head, the people underneath that you don't see. People who were appointed under a law that lets you put people in temporarily without Senate confirmation in many cases for 130 days. Well, we're now more than 365 days into the Trump administration, and many of these people are still there illegally, and Congress isn't raising any questions about that. And who are these people and what are they doing? Well, they're not getting rid of the regulations, big thing Trump makes a deal out of, and I used to teach regulatory law at Syracuse University. What they're doing is putting the polluters in at the Environmental Protection Agency. They're putting the people who have pose a threat to our heritage of national lands at the Interior Department. At the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, people whose names have never made the news, who are in there basically saying, don't enforce the law on worker health and safety. This administration has not posted a worker death, which was tradition for 40 years. Every worker death was posted on the internet when they learned of it, since August of 2017. And there are many, many examples in the book in all these different agencies of where what those agencies are supposed to do is not being done. And this is not the fox in the hen house. This is bringing in foxes to destroy the existing hen house and design a new one for the benefit of the foxes.
Most recently, with Donald Trump going to Davos and declaring America first, what is that going to mean to the country as a whole?
Well, I just, in the fall, went 57,000 miles, effectively navigating the globe twice, to lecture about Trump and about the thing I'm most known for, tax policy. And everywhere I went, the people I talked to, government officials and cab drivers, chambermaids and college professors, they all the same thing. What happened to America? What is going on in your country? What should we think with this person in the White House? And they were deeply alarmed about it. And the decisions Trump has been making have been benefiting China at the detriment of America. They have created deep concern about whether America can be trusted. And so been deep damage done. It's going to be lasting damage, Diane, even if Trump were to be out of office tomorrow.
But at the same time, he cites Wall Street, what's happening to the economy, and so on.
Well, the economy in this country has been on the rise since 2009. The recession ended in July of 2009. If you take the average rate of job growth in the Obama years, starting when the job growth began in March of 2010, during Trump's period, it's down 10%, which, by the way, we should expect, because once you've pretty much filled out the economy, job growth will slow. The increase in prices on Wall Street, we've seen prices fall by half, too. And I wonder what Trump will say when Wall Street, as inevitably does, goes through a cycle and stock prices fall sharply. I'm sure he'll somehow come up with an excuse that it's someone's fault because he claims he should get credit for it, which he shouldn't.
Here's what I want to understand. You say nobody has done more to advance China in the world than Donald Trump. How has he done that?
Well, Donald killed the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership. I was one of the loudest, earliest, most prominent critics of the TPP, not because it was should be killed, but because it gave too much power to monopolists and corporations and diminished human rights. It needed to be adjusted. Trump comes in, he kills it, and makes no replacement. Well, China has put forth something called the RCEP that I'll guess very few listeners have ever heard of. That's the Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership. It is 15 Pacific Rim countries, but not America, plus India. And Chinese diplomats and trade emissaries are going to these countries and saying, America's in decline. Look at who's in their White House. We're the country of the future. You want to be prosperous? You want trade? Go with us. Focus on us. And Australia, when I was down there last fall, the most loyal ally America has by far, it was very clear from everybody I talked to and the news accounts, is tilting in the direction of Beijing because it makes sense. And then there's the second deal. Japan made a deal with Europe for trade. And while that deal was being signed, what was Donald Trump doing? He was speaking to a prepackaged audience in Poland where the right-wing government saw to it that only Trump supporters were there and any protesters were so far away the TV cameras couldn't cover them and they wouldn't let TV cameras get to them if they tried, seeking adoration rather than trade deals that will in the long run make us all better off.
But, you know, he says that what he's doing is going to make it better for everybody in this country.
Well, all politicians pretty much tell you that, right? Nobody's going to say, vote for me, I'm going to make things worse. First of all, he brilliantly captured the legitimate grievances of the 90% of Americans who in 2012 had lower incomes than they did in 1967, the year I graduated from high school. But he's not making things better off. At the Environmental Protection Agency, they've taken all sorts of actions that are going to make for dirtier water and dirty air and more carbon being released into the environment. Now, nobody's going to get sick and die from that tomorrow. Even if Trump serves two terms, a lot of the results will be later. But people will get cancer, and they will get asthma, and they will have heart disease from these decisions. We've removed the records that can be used to prosecute in extreme cases and civilly pursue in less extreme cases all sorts of wrongdoing by those companies that behave badly. And most companies try to behave well, but there are always some who are very badly behaved. That's why we have laws and regulations. They've corrupted those records. They've gotten rid of the experts who can testify for the government and help the government develop better policies and more efficient policies. And the reason for all of this at the core is Donald Trump has no preparation. He's never served a day of public service before he became president. He is appallingly ignorant. I quote his testimony in this book, It's Worse Than You Even Worse Than You Think, in my earlier book, The Making of Donald Trump, showing that he doesn't even understand economics, the subject on which he was given, and I emphasize that verb, given a degree by Penn.
I think that all of us were stunned to hear the language he used in regard to immigration and immigrants. Where does that come from?
Well, Donald has been a virulent racist his entire life. He was found in the 70s to have discriminated along with his father in the rental of housing to blacks and Puerto Ricans. They coded applicants, and they would tell qualified black and Puerto Rican applicants there are no apartments, and then when whites were sent with the same economics, they would show them apartments. He was fined for discriminating against blacks and women and Asians in his casinos. And there's a long history of Donald discriminating. He opened his campaign with these horrible racist comments. And, you know, there are a lot of people in America who don't like the civil rights movement but won't speak up about it. That's where this term political correctness comes from. You know, there are people who would like to be able to freely use racial and ethnic and religious slurs, and they can't if they want to maintain positions anywhere but in the worst jobs out there.
David, do you have anything good to say about Donald Trump and his presidency?
Yeah, I've spent a lot of time trying to find something I thought was positive, and I can't. I just
You'd have to make it up.
Yes, which is what Donald does all the time. I mean, we are creating what the ancient Greeks called a kakistocracy, a government by the worst of us and the most venal of us. Totally unqualified people, in some cases really bad people, and a kleptocracy.
Suppose he is found to have somehow collaborated with the Russians on the election. Suppose somehow he is impeached. You have a dire prediction.
Yes. And by the way, I don't think there's any doubt there was a conspiracy with the Russians. Just read the Rob Goldstone email that says, as part of Russia's efforts to help. That isn't a would you like help from us. That's we're already doing this together. If Trump is impeached over the Russians and convicted and removed from office, I believe that he will spend the rest of his days traveling the country, fomenting violence and revolution and saying this was illegitimate. And the reason is during the campaign, when he's trying to win votes over, he would point to black people in the audience and say, beat that guy up. Get that thug out of here. A man who was a former military officer, who came to express his support for Trump. Trump called him a thug and held him out, asked to be out of there. He told people he'd pay their legal bills if they beat people up, which he would never do, by the way. And a man who will do that has no regard for anyone but himself. Now, there'll also be a constitutional crisis if he's impeached over the Russians. If, in fact, Donald Trump is in office because of a conspiracy with the Kremlin and their active efforts to submarine our constitutional processes, and, of course, Vladimir Putin thinks democracy is a joke and has said so, can Congress allow Mike Pence to become president? He's also, therefore, Putin's beneficiary. If that happens, and it'll only happen if Democrats are in control, some people are reasonably going to say, I'm sorry, the Speaker of the House would be a Democrat and would become president. That sounds like a lawful coup d'etat. So were that to happen, I think whoever is Speaker, presumably Nancy Pelosi, that Nancy would have to say, I'm a caretaker. I will not run for office. I will not be involved in the election. I'm a caretaker till the end of the term, and behave that way.
What does that mean?
Well, it means that you might pursue policies you believe are appropriate and right for the country, but you're not going to be involved in the next selection of the president. You're not going to campaign for either candidate. You're not going to say things that benefit one candidate or hurt the other one. You're a caretaker. I mean, you're going to have to behave like Caesar's wife.
Do you see impeachment on the horizon?
If the Democrats take back control of the House and the Senate, because you have to
impeach and convict. That's a pretty big if.
It is. I agree with you. But if that happens, yes, I would expect the Democrats will move to impeach him. We don't have Mueller's report yet, but we will. And it will be very interesting to see what happens with it. You know, in New York, I live in Rochester, New York. Our governor was forced to leave office under threat of impeachment by his own party because he paid a prostitute $4,000, Elliot Spitzer. Well, we know that Donald Trump has at least twice paid off women to keep quiet about affairs he had after his marriage to Melania.
He says it's all fake news.
Well, there are documents in this case, so it's a little hard for them to. That's just Donald lying. There's no two ways about it. And I assure you there are other examples out there that just have not come to light. Why is there no call by pastors who were all over Bill Clinton over his behavior, including lying? Why is there no call by Republicans who are constantly telling us that, you know, government should control women's bodies and we should be a more religious country and whatnot to remove Trump over this? Now, I watched the Reverend Franklin Graham asked about this on TV the other day, and he said, well, you know, that was 10 years ago, and Donald Trump is a changed man. Now, I don't know about you, Diane, but I'm 69 years old. I'm not much different than I was at 59. You know, by the time you get to be in your round or mid-20s, you're baked. Very few people change a lot after that. And where's the evidence Donald Trump has changed? He hasn't changed one iota. He's the Trump he's always been.
Dave, thank you.
Thank you, Diane.
And that's it for this week. I'd love to hear what's on your mind. Connect with us on Facebook and Twitter. Send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org, or leave us a voicemail. The number is 202-854-8851. Or go to our website, dianereen.org. Our theme music was composed by Cliff Harvey. Comes to us courtesy of the Capitol Soundtrack Project here at WAMU. The show is produced by Sandra Baker and Allison Brody. Our engineers are Jake Cherry, Al Reynolds, and Douglas Bell. Thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.